Good morning and welcome to Shattering Mess. I am Yana. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the deadly and the destructive myths that are associated with religion, politics, patriotism, the media, military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring behind those headlines while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 10 to 20 years. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. Our phone number over the next 2 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, is toll-free, 877-376-4545. During the Salem News this morning, which is a Christian news source, we had an endorsement for the notion that if you join Christian Mingle, you'll find God's partner for your life. What do you think about that, Scott?
That sounds kind of dum 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 dum.
Yeah, welcome to the nature of religion. As we move through the news this morning, we're also going to find a little bit about Muslim Mingle. It has a better roll off the tongue, the alliteration I sort of like. And so after we consider the events in Israel, we will turn to Muslim Mingle. Dateline Jerusalem, this is from CNN. Could Israel be considering a monumentous concession that would change the course of 40 years of history with the Palestinians? Well, to begin, as we talked yesterday, there is no such thing as a Palestinian, and the Yehudim and Yisraelites have a history with Yisrael that goes back fully 4,000 years. There is no history with the people who are mythically known as the Palestinians in that place. A news report, a show of goodwill and diplomatic murmurs by the United States and its Arab partners, are stroking hopes that the glacial budge in Israel's position could lead Israelis and the mythical people known as the Palestinians, I'm adding that to correct the document that I'm reading, to talk seriously about peace again. You know, there has never been peace in the history of Islam. It is true that that the Palestinians are Arabs, and that's really all they are. They're just Muslim Arabs. There is no such thing as a Palestinian. There was not even a mention of Palestine prior to the upheaval that the Muslim Arabs began following the Holocaust, when Yehudim were offered 0.02% of the Middle East. That's when this myth of a Palestinian people in a place of called Palestine began to grow. But you know, if you look at the history of Islam, when Muhammad created Islam, the pagan Arabs of the time had no history of ever leaving their borders to wage war on anyone. They were not known to plunder or pillage. They had no militias. There isn't a single record in Saudi Arabia, Arabia as it used to be, nor among any of the literate nations around Arabia, which would include the Persians, which would include the Greeks, which would include the Egyptians, which would include the Babylonians and the Assyrians, even the Byzantines. There isn't a single record of Muslims prior to Muhammad becoming warlike terrorists and barbarians attacking their neighbors. Muhammad creates Islam, and in the first 10 years of the Islamic era, he leads 75 terrorist raids. They're murderous. The women are raped, the men are killed, the children are enslaved. The victims have their lands confiscated and all of their possessions robbed. 75 terrorist raids in the first 10 years of the Islamic era. Following Muhammad's death, Muslims fight the war of compulsion, forcing all who live in Arabia to either surrender and submit to Islam or die. Once Arabia is unified under Islam, once its poison is fully ingested, Muslims flee out of Arabia, killing over 200 million people from India to the far west coasts of Africa up into southern Europe. 200 million people dead as a result of this vicious religion. It has never known peace. There is no peace in Islam. All of the calls for killing in Islam are open-ended. They're not for a specific place or for a specific time. They are for the whole world. They are for all time. So long as Islam exists, there will be no peace. If you think that there'll be peace in Israel when the West capitulates, particularly the United States capitulates to the Muslims there, then just look at Syria. Look at Libya. Look at Egypt. Look at Iraq. Look at Afghanistan. Look at Pakistan. Look at any of these nations, including the Sudan and Somalia. If you think it's such a good idea to create a state for terrorists, look at the examples all around. You know, it's amazing that the United States would muddle here again. Everything we have touched in the Middle East has turned to goo. We have consistently made very bad situations much worse. We are the reason that there's a civil war where 100,000 people have died in Syria. Had we not invaded Iraq and given Iraq to Iran, that would not be the case. We are the reason that Iran is on the cusp of completing its nuclear bomb. We are the reason that terrorism has returned to Iraq. We are the reason behind the upheavals in Egypt. Haven't we mucked up the Middle East enough to recognize we ought to opt out? The only place throughout the entire Middle East that has any degree of sanity, any degree of civil nature, any degree of justice and opportunity is Israel. And what is the United States doing trying to screw that up too? I mean, if you are a patriot, if you support this government, you're an imbecile. Get the hell out. Leave them alone. You know, you've already bankrupted this country. You've turned this country into the laughingstock of the world. And now you want to go and mess up Israel? What is it that the United States has become so bad that the only way that the United States can look good by comparison to other countries is to destroy any country that there's any hope and opportunity or economic prosperity or freedom? Is that our goal? Or has this administration become so Islamic in its leanings that all it cares about is giving Muslims what they want, what they crave, fully recognizing that the consequence of doing so will be what we witnessed in Egypt, what we are witnessing now in Turkey, what we're witnessing in Syria, in Yemen, Somalia, the Sudan. The Reuters news agency quoted an Israeli official last week who said Israel agreed to a peace plan based upon the 1967 borders with land swaps. The moment Israel capitulates to that, we're within 15 years of world war. It will be identical to what happened with Neville Chamberlain when he went to Czechoslovakia, a place that he had no influence over, should have had no influence over, and gave the Nazis much of Czechoslovakia, all of the high ground of Czechoslovakia. And rather than satiating the bloodlust of the Nazis, which is a religion very similar to Islam, all he did is enrage them and embolden them, and within a year there was a world war where 55 million people died. The only possible outcome of surrendering the West Bank to the Muslims, especially after having narrowed Israel at the waist by having Israel surrender Gaza to the Muslims, is World War III. The moment we force this upon Israel, two things will happen. One is we will have lit the fuse for World War III, an Islamic war against Israel that will spew out of that and engulf the entire world in war, and the utter destruction of the United States. Because we will have been responsible, and there are consequences for that. So be aware. For those who are patriotic, for those who are political, for those who support this government, or even the one prior, because George Bush wanted to do the same thing, that the moment we force Israel to give up the West Bank, the moment we do that, and to make concessions on Jerusalem, we have lit the fuse of World War III. It will be impossible to snuff out. Billions of people will die, and the United States' largest cities will be destroyed. That is the consequence. It is inevitable. It is something the United Nations demanded in Resolution 1967. Yes, you see, the United Nations doesn't like Israel. And the United Nations loves Islam. And so when all of Israel's neighbors, having failed to destroy Israel in the War of Independence, massed their troops on Israel's borders, blockaded Israel so that it could receive no assistance from anyone, and began to shout that they would drive Israel into the sea, both in Egypt and in Syria, telling them this was the ultimate and last war, and that Israel would soon be destroyed. The day before that war would have begun, Israel conducted a preemptive strike. In 6 days, the arrogant Muslims were destroyed. Israel could have moved into Cairo and captured all of Egypt. They had captured the Sinai. They could have been in Damascus on the seventh day. They controlled everything. They had won. All of that land could have been theirs and should have been theirs. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. As I read these words about the potential for Israel to capitulate based upon the ultimatums by the United States, come to recognize that the United States is really dastardly behind the scenes. That's one of the things we learned from the WikiLeaks documents, is that the United States is incredibly and grotesquely immoral behind the scenes, the way that it plays. And for the United States to push Israel to the point that it's even considering this, the kinds of threats the United States is making quietly have to be repulsive. You know, we are already supplying the Muslim nations surrounding Israel, who have but one enemy, which is Israel, with 24 times more weapons than we supply Israel. 24 to 1. We've been doing that for decades now. We are in a position where we enrich all of Israel's neighbors because of OPEC and our positions relative to not developing our own energy reserves here in America. And all of our diplomatic efforts are opposed to Israel and in favor of her foes. Now, that's stupid because Israel's foes also happen to be America's foes. That's stupid because Israel's foes are amongst the most despicable places on earth to live. They treat women as if they were dirt. They're savages, brutal, vicious murderers, kidnappers, robbers, terrorists. And yet we have sided with them routinely against Israel. Unbelievably stupid. Well, this article goes on to say it's something the United Nations has demanded in the resolutions of 1967. Now, imagine that. I mean, almost every nation on earth is now defined in terms of its territory by the land that it conquered. The United States is is that way. Much of the territory of the United States is either land that we stole from other countries or other people, or that we bought from those who had previously taken advantage of others. So if Israel is to, if the same standard for Israel should exist for the United States, then the United States is doesn't exist. America's history relative to its growth as in territory is despicable. Israel's is not. I mean, if you want to apply that standard to Israel, then America has to vanish. We have a history that is utterly despicable. Israel doesn't. It is absurd to tell Israel that after they prevail in three wars where Islam in a unified fashion chose to wipe them off the map, and they prevailed in all three wars, and they retained a very small buffer of what historically has always been their land. And we want them to get it back so that they become indefensible. We want to reward the tactics of terrorism that have been deployed to bring the world to this position. It's a sign that either the United States is grotesquely immoral, ignorant to the point of being stupid, or wholly irrational, incapable of exercising good judgment. Take your pick. But if you're amongst those who support your country and its endeavors worldwide, who think America is a moral force for good in the world, then I'm going to tell you, you're borderline insane. This requires Israel to withdraw from occupied territories. Why don't they ask America to withdraw from occupied territories? Why don't we give the entire western three-quarters of America back to the Indians? Why don't we give southern America back to the Mexicans? Why don't we? You know, if they're occupied territories because they were gained through war, then why are they to give them back and we are not? I mean, America's wars were offensive. Israel's wars were defensive. I mean, they're on the high moral ground. We're not. We have no right. Anyone in the world, from the United Nations to America, has no right to impose this on Israel. Mind you, God gave this land to them. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. Back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. We have Nick on the line. Hello, Nick. How are you this morning?
Good. Good morning. I'm good.
Good.
I want to ask if you know who it is or anything about a person named Abu Hurairah.
Yeah. Hurairah is the, Hurairah. Individual is fairly well known in the archives of Islam. He is the fellow that is, the source of a disproportionate number of hadith. He's the first isnad listed on many hadith. Isnad is the chain of reporters that are assigned to hadith. So a hadith to be considered official has to have the first isnad or chain of oral reporters has to be someone who was a companion of Muhammad. And then the next on down the line also, because, you know, the like the Quran, the Hadith was passed on from mouth to ear, mouth to ear, mouth to ear, generations after generation. So in the Hadith, a special attention is applied to who the first, second, and third Isnad reports conveyed this, and
keeps the chain of who says what to who.
Yeah, the Isnad tells us who it is that has passed on this statement. I mean, almost all of the Hadith are statements either made by Muhammad statements by Muhammad's companions to Muhammad, upon which Muhammad responds. So almost all of them are made either from Muhammad or interactions with Muhammad. And this fellow is the most prolific of the isnad, or therefore oral reporters of the sayings from Muhammad. I'll give you an example. Here's one of his hadith. He said, I was talking about, let's see if I can find one here that would be interesting. Here's one. While on the road to Mecca for the pilgrimage, the wind blew so hard that Umar asked, "Can anyone narrate to us something the Prophet said about wind?" None of those present could answer. When the news of this reached Abu Hurayra, he rode up to Umar and said, "Commander of the believers, I was told that you asked about wind, and I myself heard the Prophet say, 'The wind is a spirit from Allah. It brings mercy and it brings torment. Therefore, when you experience it, do not curse it, but ask Allah for its goodness and seek refuge in Him from its harm.'" That's the kind of stuff that came from him. Pretty, yeah.
Prophet of Doom contain this guy in it, like
yes. He is listed as an Isnad, or the first of the oral reporters, on I think it's 5,700 of these hadith, and so many of those that are chronicled in Ishaq's Sirah, or biography of Muhammad, many of those chronicled in Tabari's history of Islam's formation in the Tariq, and many of those that are reported by both Muslim and Bukhari have him listed as the first in the line of reporters. His isnads are all over the board. I mean, they're like everything else that we have from Muhammad. There's many that are warlike and jihadist. There's many that are just unbelievably stupid, like the one I just read to you. That they're just like all the rest of the hadith. They depict Muhammad as a perverted moron.
Oh, thank you very much. I like that search bar in your on the Prophet of Doom website, where I can just put that fellow's name and
Let me tell you what I did in Prophet of Doom that wouldn't help you a lot in this particular question is that I referenced all the hadith that I cited. I referenced the nomenclature that is used in each of the four books. Like on the Sirah, I simply referenced the English translation of the Sirah by Guillaume, the page and the edition that quotation is found on. And Tabari, the English translation is done by by SUNY, the State University of New York, and it's in various volumes, and I would cite the volume and the page that the quotation is found on in the only English translation of Tabari's collection of hadith. In Muslim and Bukhari, I cited the nomenclature that is the most commonly used, although in those there are many differences between how they are numbered in terms of volume and specific hadith. What I did not do, well, I described the nature of an isnad, and sometimes I listed who was the first to report it. For the most part, if I had put down the list of 10 to 15 names every time that I shared one of the many thousands of hadith and Prophet of Doom, it would have made the book, instead of 1,000 pages, it would have been 2,000 pages. But if you go to either any of the source materials that I cited, in those source materials, under that specific reference, you'll find the chain of reporters are isnad. And this fellow is the most prevalent of them.
Thank you for...
Sure.
Info.
Sure. Sure. One of the things that is important in this regard is to recognize that the same individuals who passed on the Quran to us are the same individuals who passed on the Hadith. The Quran and the Hadith come from the same individual, from Muhammad. And so their credibility is identical. If Muhammad's Quran citations are untrue, then his hadith citations are untrue, and vice versa. If his hadith citations are untrue, his Quran statements are untrue. And if the hadith have been corrupted over time, if they're not trustworthy in terms of what Muhammad actually did and said, then the Quran isn't either, because, again, came from the same person, passed on through the generations in exactly the same way. And so there really is no difference. And I know Muslims will have a conniption fit over this. But if you want to approach this from an informed and rational point of view, there is no difference between the Quran and the Hadith. They come from the same person. They were presented to us and memorialized, handed down to us in exactly the same way by the same individuals in the same manner at the same time. And so it is also important to recognize that as it relates to Sharia law, as it relates also just to the general practice of the religion of Islam, the hadith are vastly more important than is the Quran. Muslims will tell you the Quran is their, you know, their holy book. Well, the Quran is a jumbled mess. It has no context, no chronology, and the practice of Islam and the law of Islam, Sharia, are based entirely on Muhammad's words and example. It's called Sunnah. The only place you find Muhammad's words and example is in the Hadith. And so these Hadith are totally and completely responsible for Islam, its practice, and its name. And, you know, if you read particularly the history of this individual, what you find is that he is the most responsible also for passing on the initial surahs of the Quran. He even rivals Muhammad himself and says, you know, with Muhammad, there were cases where he forgot a surah or misquoted it, but this fellow always had it right. Huriyah is the man's name. So that's the history of it. And the reason that's important and germane to our current discussion is because what America is doing is trying to turn over the only sane and civil part of the Middle East, the only part that's not completely destroyed and corrupted and perverted by Islam, to the Muslims. Why on earth would anyone do that? Well, there's another story here. This is, we're going to call, Muslim Mingle, in Dubai from CNN. Norwegian interior designer Marte Deborah Dalev had spoken out after being handed a 16-month prison sentence in Dubai. What was her crime? Now, she was given a 16-month prison sentence in Dubai. What was this Norwegian interior designer's crime? She was raped. She went to police and reported the rape by a Muslim colleague. The 24-year-old was convicted and sentenced on charges of having unlawful sex. You see, if you're raped by a Muslim in an Islamic country, rather than the Muslim being charged with a crime, the victim is charged with a crime. That's how. But understand, it is Islam that we're trying to give Israel to. And it is an Islam where the victim of rape is sentenced to jail. She had unlawful sex because she was raped. And then she was also jailed for making a false statement and illegal consumption of alcohol, which was, by the way, served in a bar in Dubai. Her story is dominating the headlines in Norway, and it has raised serious questions over the way women who allege sexual assault are treated in the United Arab Emirates. Why couldn't the folks from CNN tell us the truth? It's not the case of just the United Arab Emirates. In every Islamic country, when a woman is raped, she's the one who goes to jail. We see this every day in Afghanistan. We saw it routinely in Iraq. When Americans are in a position to witness what's happening in the Islamic world, it is ubiquitous. It's part of Islam. Because you see, in Islam, rape is sanctioned. Even in the Quran, rape is sanctioned. In the Hadith, Muhammad was a multiple rapist. Every time that his goons savaged a civilian community, Muhammad picked first of the woman that he would rape. And so, in Islam, rape is A-OK, but the victim of rape, oh, she goes to jail. We'll be back to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Giada. We're talking about the prevalence of sexual abuse in Islam. Now, mind you, this I'm sharing this with you in concert with the realization the United States is trying to force Israel to cede vast swaths of its territory to the Muslims. And so the lone place in the Islamic Middle East that isn't ravaged by this kind of repulsive religion and therefore laws is the one place that we're trying to give to the very people who think that it is appropriate to jail the victim of rape as opposed to prosecute the rapist. Well, Marte Delev, who had been working as an interior designer in a design firm in Qatar since September 2011, told CNN on Saturday how a trip to Dubai in March with three colleagues turned into a nightmare. She said she was out drinking with her colleagues, and when she wanted to return to her hotel room at 3 a.m., which probably was not the best judgment on her part, she'd asked one of the men who was familiar with the hotel and the community to walk her back because she says the hotel was very large and confusing, and she just wanted protection on the way back. Well, when they got back to the hotel, she was taken to a room that was not hers. She was then knocked out. She awoke with the man raping her. She said that when she was there naked on the bed on her belly and this man was savagely raping her, sodomizing her, when the man finally left, she got dressed, made it downstairs, and called the police, made a report to the police of what had happened, was interrogated by the police. In fact, the police, all males at the time, said, so you only called us because you decided that you didn't like the sex? Well, as it turns out, after she was abused by the police, she was given a piece of paper that said, we're going to keep your passport, and the piece of paper says you're going to be charged with the crime of unlawful sex. She then got hold of her employer, told their employer what had happened, and her employer gave her the advice. He said, hey, listen, if you just go in and say it was consensual sex and that it was not rape, then all of this will blow over. They'll give you your passport back, and you can be out of there. So she went back to the police and said, okay, I'm told to tell you that it was consensual sex. Give me my passport back, and I'm going to leave. And they said, okay, well, now we're going to add the charge of filing a false report to your list of charges. They convicted her, and she was serving a 16-month prison sentence, her crime having been raped. So it became so much of an issue in Europe that yesterday The government said, all right, of Dubai said, you know, we've built all these fancy hotels to try to attract European money here. So now maybe the best thing is let's free her because this is really bad for business. We're not going to get any Europeans, particularly women, willing to come here if we imprison for 16-month jail terms the victims of rape. So she was let free yesterday. But can you imagine a religion so disgusting? And what we find is in Afghanistan, where the United States stupidly invaded that country and on a false pretenses, that after our invasion of Afghanistan, as bad as the conditions were for Muslim women prior to our invasion, they're vastly worse now. And there are countless little girls in jail in Afghanistan, and their crime is either they were raped and they're in jail because they were raped, or they're in jail because their family sold them to some dirty old man and they decided that, you know, they don't want to be the sex slave and they don't want to be physically abused by some Muslim man. And when they refused, they're thrown in jail. Now, that leads us to a story that was reported by the BBC earlier this week. The headline begins, more than 30 million girls risk being subjected to female genital mutilation over the next decade. That's how many little girls had their genitals mutilated by their mothers over the last decade. What we'll find, and we're going to return to this story in our program tomorrow, is there's a direct correlation between the prevalence of Islam and the prevalence of female genital mutilation. It is something we need to know because the United States is trying to force Israel to give up its land to people who practice such savagery. We'll be back with Shattering Myths in a moment.